to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey, and I'm here in Grays Lake, Illinois today at Reformed Forum Studio. And I'm delighted to be back with you with some friends and an exciting topic. It's a big, big day. Been looking forward to this for really a couple months and particularly several weeks since I got the book. But before we announce that, let me introduce to you, we have Jim Cassidy, who is the pastor of South Austin OPC down in South Austin, Texas. Welcome back, Jim. It's good to see you today.
It's good to be here, Camden. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's good to talk to you. It's been a few episodes since we've had you on, mm-hmm. so glad to have you back.
Yep.
We also have with us, I believe for the second time now, but certainly we've known about our brother for a long time through his scholarship, but we're welcoming back to the program Dr. James Eglinton, who is the Meldrum Senior Lecturer in Reformed Theology at the University of Edinburgh, and he's the author of a very important new book. Welcome back to the program, James. It's so good to have you with us today.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
Yes, today we're going to be speaking, obviously, about Herman Bavinck and Reformed theology and everything that Bavinck is. James is at the forefront of Bavinckian scholarship and doing a lot of work there, not only himself, but also overseeing many graduate students who go on to professorships in other institutions. So we're seeing in many ways, I don't know if it's a renaissance in the sense that we lost something and regained it, but there's definitely very good advances, and it's a good time to be studying Herman Bavinck, and what a wonderful figure to study. But today we're going to be speaking about a new biography, not just any type of biography, but a critical biography of Bavinck here, published by Baker Academic, written by our guest today, Dr. James Eglinton. This is a phenomenal book. It truly is. James, I am so thoroughly impressed. I'm not going to say that I'm surprised, because of the nature of your work and your scholarship, but I am thoroughly impressed. And wow, right here on the back, they've done a good job. And this isn't just marketing and fake, but here's the quote on the back: impeccably researched and thoroughly readable. I could not disagree with anything there from Kristen Dede Johnson at Western Theological Seminary. That's her assessment, and I concur. So this is very exciting to speak about the life of Herman Bavinck, but to do so in a compelling way rather than, you know, dry facts and dates and all that sort of thing. But we're going to get into the life of Bavinck and get behind the books to understand more of the man, which in turn, obviously, we hope will help us to understand the rich theology there in service of the church. So I guess I'll start right off and James, ask you kind of an introductory pro forma question, just to speak about the subtitle of the book. It is noted as a critical biography, and other biographies of Bavinck exist. There have been several in the Dutch language, some that were written early on, closer to the time of Bavinck's life, and there have been recent editions even in English. How is this particular work distinguished from others, and what makes it a critical biography?
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. So if you think about biographical writing, there are two main approaches you could take. One would be what we could call a commemorative biography. And there have been some of those in Dutch about Bavinck. Over the decades after he died, every so often a new, really short commemorative biography would appear, which is there just to tell the world, this is a great figure. It's kind of an exercise in reputation management as well. So a commemorative biographer has a really good idea of the story they want to tell about their figure before they begin the research or the writing. They're not so much interested in things that might not portray their figure in a flattering light. So those kinds of things tend to get airbrushed out. So if you go back a while, it would be what we imagine to be hagiography, right? The lives of saints for devotional benefit. Another approach would be a critical biography, which is a different kind of biographical writing where you're really committed to the sources. If you go back to this person's letters and diaries and their unpublished writings, the whole story of their life, for good and bad, warts and all, what kind of critical scholarship can you use to talk about their life in a more rounded way, I guess? In a way where, as the writer, you don't know what the conclusions will be before you start writing. You could be really surprised by what you find, for example, but you're committed to telling the whole story that the sources will allow you to tell. So in my case, that meant years and years, really, working with his diaries, with his letters, with unpublished manuscripts, with newspaper entries that cover his life. So with all of that kind of stuff, trying to tell a story about Bavinck that's, it's not critical in the sense of, you know, being an axe, kind of a hatchet job, just trying to tear him to bits, but it's critical in the approach that I take. I'm trying to tell the story, and I guess in a warts and all fashion, rather than this just being like reputation management to tell the world, or to tell people who think Bavinck is great. Yes, indeed, he is great. So it's a different kind of exercise. I think it's more interesting theologically. If we're committed to the idea that people are sinners and that we live in a world that's a really complex place, a one-sided story where we only highlight the obvious, easy, the low-hanging fruit is, for me anyways, as a Christian and as a biographer, less interesting, actually.
Yeah, I could tell right away, not just reading the introduction and your discussion on the sources, but even just as you read, I don't know how to put this, but I just read the book and I realize, oh, this is a serious work. And I'm using that in a very kind of hefty way. Like, this is a serious scholar who's done serious scholarship. And I just get the sense there's a gravitas to it, not just because it's thick, but I mean, it's weighty even in the material. So I appreciate that. But then you would expect if something is like that, then it would not be necessarily readable, but I found it to be very approachable. And so it doesn't sacrifice on either end. I'm curious if you could describe, open up the door for us a little bit to know more of the practice of Dutch folk at the time. Because Jan Bavinck wrote an autobiography for his own purposes as Herman's father. But then, Herman obviously wrote these diaries. I never took Dutch. I know German, so my German pronunciation might influence my Dutch and then make me make errors. Like, I know it's offscheiding, even though every fiber of my being wants to say offscheiding. But, speak about the dogbook or the practice of that. Is that unique to Bavinck, or is that something that most people did as a daily practice?
No, that's something that was widespread in his era. So something that I try and draw out in the book is that Bavinck is a modern person born into a modern family. So his father, as you mentioned, Jan Bavinck, wrote, he calls it a short sketch of my life, but it was like 42,000 words long. And he wrote it as an old man not too long before he died, in a really modern way. So people in that period developed a very keen sense of their individuality, of their experiences as unique, and of time is passing so rapidly and the world around you is changing all the time, because you've got all kinds of big social changes around you. You have industrial changes, technology, everything is just hurtling forward. And you're very aware that your experience of that is unique. And you don't want those unique memories and experiences to be forgotten. So if you're a modern person like Jan Bavinck, Bavinck's father, you write down those experiences. And he wrote this huge, not in any way short sketch of his life, which is a very modern practice. And Herman did something similar. So he never wrote, as far as I'm aware anyway, a long, a personal autobiography at the end of his life like his father did. But he chronicled his own life from his teenage years and to the very end in Dagboeken, as you say, in these a day book, literally a journal, where he's just constantly writing down his experiences, his thoughts. There are lots of written prayers in there as well. And they're part of this awareness of the individual, of the modern person as, you know, that you are a particular person, that you're not just a kind of generic human being whose own experiences don't matter that much. So I think he's really modern in that regard as well, and wants to try and reflect on his experiences. Something interesting that I came across in doing this work is that for a period of his life as a student, he was keeping two journals, two Dagboeken, and writing sometimes different accounts of the same day's experience, which was really fun to find. And I think my theory on why he did that is that one of them is actually a tiny, tiny book. When you hold it physically, it's really small and you can keep it in your pocket. And then the other is a more expensive book to buy. It's much larger, so you have more space and you can't carry it with you. So I think that he would quickly write his thoughts on experiences as they happened. And he would do this a lot as a student. And then at the end of the day, when he's thought more about them, you then get a longer, carefully crafted entry on that day and on his thoughts and things. And sometimes what he writes actually differs, and his interpretation of his experiences. But it is really fascinating. It's also part of childhood Christian devotional culture in that historical period as well. So parents would encourage their children to keep a daily journal like this, where you record your, I guess, your self-awareness. What kind of a person am I becoming in my teenage years? What am I praying for example? So it's an aspect of personal discipline, of character formation, and it's part of the wider culture, and Herman Bavinck is very much a part of that. So for them, it was really important to chronicle your life, your own life.
And you even identify in some places, which really shed light on his experiences and his perceptions, that that there is even record, whether they're in the Dachboken or not, you have records of purchases he's made at times.
Yeah, indeed. So and his so he has this bundle of student era booklets, and some of them are journals, but there's also a receipts book. So you know, you have to be well in control of your finances as a student at a receiving a pretty privileged education. So you know, and you don't have like a credit-based economy or anything like that. So you have to measure what's going in and what's going out in terms of your money each month. So we actually do have pretty detailed accounts of which books he bought, you know, how much money he was spending on cigars and beer and all that kind of stuff. So we have those actually all throughout his student years, which is really interesting. The high school that he went to, he had accountancy classes there. So it's just part of this culture of being a good steward of your resources. And that comes through when he goes to university, through him keeping, you know, detailed financial records of what he was buying.
Sure. That makes total sense. You know, obviously there's so much material here and detail that my goal here is to whet people's appetite so that they go pick up the book themselves and read it perhaps multiple times and then read Bavinck's theology per se. So, you know, I'd love to have a 24-hour conversation just on all the details and minutiae of Bavinck. I realize I can't do that and I wouldn't be a good steward and a host in doing that. But big picture, you know, Bavinck was raised in a challenging and transitional time period. You already mentioned about all the shifts going on in society. And that's not just, you know, relative to them, but I mean, in world history, this is a pretty enormous transitional time. But how is it evident that Herman, along with his father and his brother, I suppose, really wrestled with the questions of the time, but particularly as they might have applied to Orthodox Reformed participation in modern society?
Yeah, that's a great question. So for the Bavinck family, these questions about what place do you have if you're an Orthodox Calvinist in modern society, I mean, those were the questions that animated their lives. And the questions that Bavinck's father wrestled with and that Bavinck and his brothers wrestled with as well. I think, you know, there's a stereotype of the Netherlands that the people in the English-speaking world have today that, you know, it's the most liberal of liberal democratic countries in the world. Mm. And people just assume that it's always been like that. But you don't have to go back very far into Dutch history to find that it's pre-democratic phase. So, So Jan Bavinck, Herman's father, was originally from Germany and then migrated into the Netherlands in search of religious freedom, actually. But in his youth in the Netherlands, you don't have democracy. You have an authoritarian monarch who tries really hard to exercise control over religion and who wants to influence the Dutch Reformed Church to be you know, theologically liberal, to be really moralistic, to be a moralizing force to produce well-behaved, responsible citizens who are rational and who are anti-supernatural and all that kind of stuff. So in that context, if you are reformed at that period, you don't have the freedom to be reformed and not be in the Dutch Reformed Church. So there are government offices that fund minister stipends. There's a government office that tries to tell you what you're going to sing in church on Sundays with the actual hymns that they produce for you, which tend to be quite moralistic, patriotic, and so on. So there was a movement, the Afscheiding, which you already mentioned. So a secession in 1834, when a group of, well, originally one pastor, and then the movement grew and grew, and they left the Dutch Reformed Church, and then they formed the Secession Church, eventually became the Christian Reformed Church. So Jan Bavinck was watching this happening from the other side of the border in Germany, and there was a really similar secession movement in his part of Germany as well. So he was he was converted in that kind of a context, joined the German equivalent of the Dutch Secession Church, and then trained for the ministry in the Netherlands, and then pastored in Germany and moved back to the Netherlands. But while he was doing this, there still wasn't democracy. That didn't happen until 1848, after, you know, Jan Bavinck has been a pastor for, well, he was training to be a pastor at that point. And to be part of a contraband church was really dangerous. Your church services could be interrupted by the police, happened a lot. The pastor would be taken away, beaten up, fined, imprisoned. And then the fines go up each time the pastor is caught preaching outside of the approved church. So if you grew up in that kind of a context, that's not an easy place to exist as a reformed Christian, when your understanding of being reformed means that you are a pariah in society, that you have no real prospects for social advancement for your children, when you're at risk of imprisonment all the time. So that's trying to work out what's your place as a reformed Christian who just doesn't fit into the approved form of being reformed is really difficult. That all changed in 1848, when you have a year of revolutions all across Europe, and it's the end of the period of strongman monarchs, and then you get liberal democracy springing up all across Europe. And that happened in the Netherlands as well. Happened a bit more slowly in Germany, where Jan Bavinck was from. But all of a sudden, these seceders who'd been persecuted and imprisoned, all of a sudden overnight they're free, and they can worship as they wish. And the state stops privileging any one church. Instead, everyone's told, this is a level playing field. We're not going to approve any of you. This is a new social experiment where you have to work out what the space you have is in society now that you're not being persecuted. So for the Dutch seceders, the big challenge there is that until then, they've been campaigning to have, some of them were campaigning just to have freedom of religion, and they aspired to an American way of thinking about that and a separation of church and state. But for a lot of them, they were campaigning to have the king recognize them as the true Dutch Reformed Church, because the church that they left had wandered so far from its heritage. So these seceders, all of a sudden, who are free, have to work out, this is a new society, and none of us has experienced pluralistic liberal democracy before. What does this mean for our children? Can we send them to university now? Do we want to do that? Will they lose the faith if we give them those kinds of social ambitions? So the seceders have, post 1848, in this new age of freedom and equality, have all these questions to think through. And the Bavinck family are so interesting because they were extremely ambitious for their children, and they wanted to be, let's say, separate in terms of church identity, but they wanted to be integrated in society, and they thought that Christians had a duty to do that. So they chose really ambitious educational tracks for their children, sent them their sons to the top state universities. The three sons who survived into adulthood, although one of them died as a young adult, went to study at state universities in law, theology, and medicine. And those are the most socially ambitious careers that you could try and follow at that point. So the Bavincks are so interesting because they wrestle with all of these questions. And the parents hadn't grown up with liberal democracy or freedom or anything like that. The kids are natives in that kind of terrain. But so you have parents and children together who are trying to think through what is our place in our society? How much freedom do we really have? And how do you follow Christ in this brand new society, in this social experiment?
What's interesting as you recount Bavinck's educational path, and we can walk through that in broad strokes, but it is interesting to see the way he goes, and he has this privileged education in large measure, and he's trying to wrestle with what it means to be an Orthodox conservative Calvinist, even in the midst of modernist and in the colloquial way, the liberalized views, even though they tolerated him. Now, some scholars early on, some Bavinck scholars and previous biographers at least seem to have questioned Bavinck's intellectual abilities, at least early in life, and his academic performance. But is that really sustained by the historical evidence? What did you uncover as you were reading through his journals and other sources?
No, it's not sustained at all in terms of concrete sources that are very reliable. So this all comes from Bavinck's first Dutch biographer, Valentijn Hepp, who wrote quite a long, very entertaining biography very quickly as Bavinck was dying and shortly after when he had died. So Hep was very happy to use entertaining, charming folk histories, things that you heard by word of mouth about Bavinck. And one of the stories that Hep includes about the young Bavinck is so his father was a pastor, as we said. He moved to a town to be the pastor there that had a really good and quite kind of distinct and modern Christian boarding school that had a very modern curriculum. And in Hep's story, Bavinck's father thought that Herman's older brother was really smart and had a lot of academic potential and should go to this school, but he didn't think Herman was smart. And the teacher from the school says, "Oh, but let me try Herman out as well, and we'll see how he gets on." And then the teacher discovers, "Wow, he's a diamond in the rough. He's an uncut diamond, and we need to smooth him." But so I think where this comes from originally is a romantic search for, you know, when a genius is first discovered. And it's part of the romantic conception of one of the great men of history, that you have to have that in your story as a rite of passage, when someone first spots a genius who could have easily been missed. But the big problem with Hep's story is that at that point, Herman didn't have an older brother. So he had a sister, but no older brother. And the story just doesn't check out. Hep himself says, "I was told this by a person in a position to know it." And it's a kind of story that you've heard on the basis of what someone said in the 1880s. And that's a recollection of a private conversation between Herman Bavinck's father and a teacher in, you know, the 1860s. It just doesn't work, but it's, you can see the way that it gets kind of edited and chopped and changed a bit throughout the history of people thinking about Bavinck's life. So, you know, there's a Dutch biography that came out in the 60s where it's a really good biography in many, many regards, but this story is still there just without the big brother in the story. And then in Gleason's biography, which is the more recent English one, the section on his childhood is called A Diamond in the Rough.
It's titled after the myth.
Yeah, indeed. So that's, I think that it reveals a lot about how, you know, there was a kind of romantic folklore and how you construct a story of a genius that they have to have been discovered at some point. But actually, I think in Dutch culture at that point in history, people didn't have a very strongly developed sense of childhood behaviors as something that you spend a lot of time thinking about in the way that we do now and in the way that later romantics did. But, you know, when Jan Bavinck was around, I don't think that really existed in Dutch culture. I think it's a later way of looking back and telling stories about people in the past.
Mm-hmm. Again, the value of a critical biography. Not saying the other people aren't working with any sources or of the sort, but that's the value here with this particular volume, that you, James, have done the work and really looked at things afresh, and it shows. Jim?
Hey, James. So I'm fascinated by the work that you've done on the so-called two Bavincks. And we're sort of now backtracking to the introduction or the initial part of your book. But I think it's important for our listeners to maybe get a little glimpse of that debate and your contribution to it. Especially as we get into Bavinck's education and then his intellectual development. Anyway, would you just be willing to take a couple of minutes to explain to us sort of that whole two Bavinck debate and sort of your contribution to how we might best understand Bavinck as a historical figure?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So Bavinck's life is characterized by two things, I think. One is his conservative Calvinist orthodoxy, and the other is his active participation in modern society. So for him to be a Calvinist does not mean that you don't read, you know, the latest developments in psychology or science or anything like that, and that, you know, you live in your mind as though it's still the 17th century. So he's a Calvinist who's very much a man of his own day, with all the latest developments of things in his period. So, and I guess to a lot of readers over the past 100 years, that has seemed to be quite an odd combination. How can you be an orthodox and modern? Because a lot of people assume those two things exist in tension. Mm-hmm. So that gave rise over the course of the 20th century to people reading Bavinck and saying, but how can he want to be these two things? And this seems to be almost like there are two people writing here. And then that's the way that it developed in the ways that people would speak about him and write about him, that there was an Orthodox Bavinck and a modern Bavinck. And the puzzle of Bavinck's life was that he could never choose which of those two he wanted to be. So people would talk about him as a Jekyll and Hyde figure within the Reformed tradition. So you get lots of talk about this, about two poles in Bavinck's thought, about there being two Bavincks. And the way that that started to develop in literature on Bavinck was that it was almost like redaction criticism in higher critical studies of the Bible, where, you know, you're trying to find which author really wrote this section of Isaiah, but there was no one Isaiah, or, you know, the same with Genesis or something like that. So you would find people who would write about, you know, this section is the modern Bavinck. You move on a few pages and it's the Orthodox Bavinck, and then he moves back, and which is a really fruitless way, I think, to try and read him. And it relies on a lot of just assumptions about Bavinck that I don't think work. So my first book, it was called Trinity and Organism. And it was, so there I really pushed back quite hard against what I call the two Bavincks hypothesis. And I think that theologically, Bavinck's understanding of Calvinism meant that to be orthodox doesn't preclude participation in modernity, but also modernity itself is a thing that can accommodate orthodoxy. And I think that's what Bavinck was trying to do. He thought that orthodoxy is something that expresses itself and can express itself in any period in culture or history. And that's part of Christianity being a Catholic faith. It's not a faith that only works in the 16th century or in the Netherlands or in America. So I pushed back quite hard against that and said that we're wrong to talk about two Bavincks. We should only speak about one Bavinck. And you can actually see this in his theology with how it works, that diverse things hold together in the ways that Bavinck thinks, even things like orthodoxy and modernity. So I pushed back really hard against that in my first book. But the first book was about Bavinck's theology and not really Bavinck as a theologian. But I think in saying there weren't two Bavincks, there was only one, there's a kind of biographical impulse that was resounding in the first book, even though it's not a biography, that then led to me to think that I need to write a Bavinck biography that shows, you know, there was only one Bavinck, and what does it look like then when we don't look at his life assuming that everything was divided? Actually, I think he had a really capacious sense of the Catholicity of the Christian faith as a faith for all of life and a faith for every culture and a faith for every historical period, including the new one that he was born into. So I think the product of that then is the account of his life that I've tried to provide in the biography.
Sure. Yeah. And in many ways that leads to some surprising things, at least would have been surprising, I imagine, for his contemporaries, but then to us, maybe surprising who don't understand, you know, that contemporary culture. I wanted to ask you about that as we look at the unfolding of Bavinck's development, his movement from the gymnasium, eventually on to Compen. You think of Leiden, his time there. But how was Bavinck's educational path surprising when it's compared to his contemporaries, such as a figure like Kalf?
Yeah, so... So Bavinck's educational path was that he went to a boarding school, but in the town where his parents lived and where his dad was a pastor. But it was a very modern kind of school. It was a Christian school explicitly, but you know, you would learn. I mean, he learned English, German, French, Dutch, obviously, music, you know, accounting, all these different things. What was in its own time just a very dynamic educational environment. So he was really privileged to go to a school like that. I've never found anything by Jan Bavinck that says, I took up this call to go to the congregation there because of the school. But his dad was so ambitious for him, so it wouldn't surprise me if the fact that the school was there and his kids could go there if he moved to this congregation, wouldn't surprise me if that was a factor in his decision. So he went to a school like that. After that, he went to a gymnasium, which is, and you still have them in the Netherlands and in Germany and in lots of northern continental Europe. So it's a classical high school that prepares you for university education. So, you know, lots of your lessons are taught in Latin, you do lots of Greek, you do lots of classics. So the school that he went to was a really prestigious one. The prime minister at that time in the Netherlands had gone to that school. Pope Adrian, the only Catholic pope, the only Dutch pope, I should say.
Yeah,
I've gone to that school.
Well, there's a Freudian slip there. Who knows?
Yeah. So Pope Adrian, the only Dutch pope, had gone to this school as well. So it's a really prestigious place, and you know, if you think about the social context of the time, literacy rates were rising in the Netherlands, but most Dutch children, if they received an education, also worked in farms and factories at the same time. And so to be in full-time education, not to have to work in a farm or work in a factory, you know, because this is industrialization is happening, you're in a really privileged position. You know, this is a period where Latin is increasingly seen as irrelevant by the new middle class that's been created by industrialization. So the people who still choose to have their kids educated in Latin, like the Bavinks, usually have very, very high social aspirations. You know, so you send your child to a school like this because you want them to go to one of the universities. And in the Netherlands at that point, you know, you have a population of, you know, 3 million or so, and you have fewer than 2,000 university students in the whole country.
And so
almost no one goes to university at that point. It's really different to what we have today, where it's you have a much larger middle class, and it's kind of a normal aspiration that, you know, lots and lots of young people go to university. So if you're in that tiny sliver of society that ends up in a classical school like this before university, the kind of people that you interact with as a teenager are going to be, you know, the politicians, the university professors, you know, the movers and shakers at that upper level of society. So so one of Bavinck's rivals in his classical high school was a guy called Gerrit Kalf, who ended up being the professor of Dutch at Leiden, which is the most prestigious university in the Netherlands at that point. And Bavinck beats him to the Dutch prize from there in school together. And it's in one of his journals that he writes, "I made one grammatical error, Kalf made three," and Bavinck wins the prize. But he won the prizes for lots of his subjects at the end of his time there. So at that point, he's very much on track. You know, he can go to any university that he wants. And but the weird thing is that he doesn't do that immediately. Instead, he goes to this, you know, small, unglamorous, unaccredited theological seminary that belongs to his own denomination. And then, you know, his friends from gymnasium don't do that. They follow the path that's exactly what you'd expect. So his educational career takes some twists and turns, has some surprises.
You know, here at Reform Forum, Gerhardus Voss is, of course, a figure that we look to as one who has taught us significantly in the area of Reformed biblical theology, but also in the area of systematic theology as well. So you talk a little bit about the relationship between Bavinck and Voss, or the Bavincks and the Vosses. Would you be able to unpack for us a little bit about the dynamic of that relationship? How did Bavinck and Voss have stuff in common, and how did they differ?
Yeah, they had a huge amount in common. So if you think of the kind of upwardly mobile middle-class family like the Bavincks, who are so ambitious for their children, the Voss family was the same. So Gerhardus went to a similar kind of school that was a French language school for his secondary schooling, for his high schooling. So they're really similar. They also have an intertwined family history as well. So the Bavinck family came from Bentheim in Germany, on the other side of the border, from this denomination that seceded from the German Reformed Church there. The Voss family came from the same really local area, had roots in the same denomination, also ended up in the Netherlands. So they have so much in common, and they're both examples of this kind of social climb that you see amongst the more socially engaged seceders who really have high hopes for what their children will achieve and who want their children to get lots of opportunities that they maybe didn't have, you know, before democracy came in. So they have lots and lots in common. I guess the most obvious difference between the two families was that from early on, the Bavinck family were against emigration. So emigration to the New World, whereas the Voss family were, they emigrated, as you'll know, and that's how Voss ends up in Michigan and then in Princeton. So if you think back to the time when you know, the seceders were persecuted, and also in Germany, where the Bavinks and the Vossis were from, where they were persecuted, you have lots and lots of emigration, both from Bentheim in Germany and from the Netherlands too, you know, to Michigan, to Canada as well. And
Iowa. Yeah.
Yeah, so you have all of that kind of emigration, and some of the big questions that seceders faced before there was democracy and before there was freedom of religion, there were questions around, you know, if you face persecution in your culture in this kind of a way, does the Reformed faith obligate you to stay, or are you free to up sticks, sail across the Atlantic and move over there? And what does that mean for the society that you leave behind? Do you abandon it to unbelief? Are you, you know, are you deciding, well, I'm not going to cast my pearls before swine anymore? So those are really practical and, you know, really rocked theological questions for them that affect, well, your entire life and the country that your children will grow up in, you know, your social prospects, all of that kind of stuff. So the Bavinks from really early on are anti-immigration. Jan Bavink was anti-immigration. Herman said really harsh things about Christians who emigrated from Netherlands to America. You know, for him, this was like the worst thing that you could imagine. And it was far worse than just being a bit pietistic in the Netherlands and staying there, but ignoring the world around you. If you're not even there doing that, the worst thing that you can do is abandon the whole thing to unbelief and move to America. And the Voss family obviously were different. So they did emigrate, and you know, their lives, Herman's life and Gerhardus Voss' life, take, you know, different directions in some ways. But I think the degree of similarity that they have and the closeness that they have in terms of temperaments, and you know, they really understood each other theologically. They also have all kinds of similar existential questions about where I belong. You know, for Voss, that is as an immigrant in America who then kind of becomes American, and but also, you know, who's very much Dutch as well. You know, how you fit in there, and as a Dutch Reformed immigrant to America, you know, where should he feel most at home? Is it in the Dutch immigrant community? How does he relate to Presbyterianism, which is, you know, so close, but is also a different branch of the confessionally Reformed tradition? You know, should he stay and teach in Grand Rapids? Should he move to Princeton? Where is his institutional home? And around the same time that Voss has all of those questions, Bavinck is also asking similar kinds of questions about where does he belong in the Netherlands? Should he stay in Kampen where he was teaching? Should he move to the Free University of Amsterdam? So they have all of these questions in the same phases of life. They're both single for a good chunk of their early lives and were very bookish as a response to that. So it's not a surprise that they understood each other very well.
They had a really close relationship. It's not merely just the families, and then, you know, they spent time with each other just because they had to. They seemed to be very close. In fact, one gentleman, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but he thought he was Bavinck's soulmate, but actually Voss was.
So Bavinck had another friend whose dad was his pastor, actually, when he was in the gymnasium as a student. And his dad was his pastor, a guy called Nicholas Dosker, who then moved to Grand Rapids to be a pastor there. And so Bavinck and this guy, Henry Dosker, were really good friends as teenagers, you know, and they were both really, really young at that point. And then Voss emigrates with his father, Dosker emigrates with his father, comes back to the Netherlands occasionally, but he spends the rest of his life in America. And they keep up their correspondence over the years. But this guy, Dosker and Bavinck, were just on different levels intellectually. You know, Dosker was no slouch, but, you know, Bavinck was just in a different kind of category, as was Voss. But Dosker didn't really understand all the kind of changes that happened in Bavinck's thought, especially when he became so influenced by Abraham Kuyper. The Seceder Church changed a lot after Dosker had moved to America. So a lot of his questions to Bavinck are questions of clarification. You know, what's going on there? What's this? What are these new ways that you have of thinking? And he didn't really understand him. But Dosker then mediates Bavinck a lot to the English-speaking world and very much sees himself as Bavinck's soulmate, as though they live kind of the same life on either side of the Atlantic, which I don't think that was a kind of mutual feeling from Bavinck.
Right. Poor Dosker. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so we all have that friend who thinks that you're like this.
You're the
like,
best friend.
We're right. Not as close as you imagine. Voss is a much more accurate American interpreter of Bavinck than Dosker was.
You mentioned Bavinck's singleness and then led him to, you know, have some extra time and bookishness early on in his life, but it's not as if he had no interest. I'd love for you to speak a bit about his relationship with Amelia early on, and also the cultural forces and societal forces involved, because, you know, if those weren't in existence, he would have most likely been married to her.
Yeah, indeed. So from his teenage years, in fact, some of the earliest journal entries that he writes as a teenager are about this young woman, Amelia Dindecker. He was really enamored with her from his teenage years until he was 31. And she was older than him as well, a few years older. But he never married her. But
she
held on in hope until he was 31 that this would happen, yeah. But it didn't. And the main reason that didn't happen was that Amelia's father would never give permission to Bavinck for him to marry her. We don't have any sources from Amelia's own hand to tell us, could be that she just didn't want to marry Herman Bavinck, but it looks like that probably wasn't the case. So in Dutch culture at that point, if you were a young man who wants to get married, until you're about 30 or so, you have to ask the prospective father-in-law's permission before you can get married. You have three opportunities to do that. So there's actually, it's legally stipulated. So you have to play your cards really carefully. A lot of the time there'd be like a sympathetic aunt who you could approach as a kind of broker to the deal. And Bavinck did this with Amelia's aunt as well. But this guy, Arie Dindecker, Amelia's father, wouldn't grant permission. And which is kind of sad and interesting, but if you ask for permission and it's refused, you have to think very carefully about how you're going to try and get a yes the next time. So if you ask too early and you're rejected by the potential father-in-law, you then, you don't want to rush back in. You want to go away and really make your case more compelling the next time. So if you're rejected three times in a row, you could then get married without parental permission, but it was socially extremely controversial not to have the parents' blessing. It was, it's noted there in your marriage certificate and so on. So you don't really want that. It would be really controversial for someone who was, who played by the rules like Bavinck. The tale of Amelia is a really sad one. He writes about her a lot in his diaries in Latin, I think, to try and keep the entry secret. But we have really epic romantic poetry in there in his diaries. There's a pretty epic marriage proposal poem. And we also have diary entries where he proposes to her. They go to church together, and he writes that, when they went to church together after this proposal, he noticed some problems, and he doesn't say what they were, but you can kind of imagine it, that they turn up in church together and sit next to each other in the pew, and he gets some icy stares from her father, and
right.
That this is not going to happen. It really does go on from his teenage years until he's 31 before he finally accepts this isn't going to happen. But it was really, I think, traumatic for him.
It's certainly something early on we get a little window into his mind, and it's a really, it's a life-changing event, really. I don't know, who knows how things might have turned out otherwise, but there's another kind of early on window into the young Bavinck that I thought was so compelling, and it really captured, for me at least, the big, large sweep of society at the time. But you reference Edward Duys Dekker, whose pen name is Multatuli, pardon my pronunciation. But alongside you reference him alongside Abraham Kuyper, and in these two prominent voices, you really describe Bavinck hearing two competing visions of the future. One is a Christian secularized and not a post-Christian secularized and atheistic, and the other is a renewal of Dutch culture through a revival of Calvinism. But how did Bavinck assess this at the time? At the time that he was presented with these two visions of the future, and would his assessment change later on in life, do you think?
Yeah, so this guy, Edward Duys Dekker, who wrote, as you say, under the name Multatuli, Latin for "I have suffered much," he was a Dutchman who worked in the Dutch East Indies and who went there and was really shocked by the exploitation of the locals, of the resources. And he came back to the Netherlands and tried to be a whistleblower, but people didn't really care. And, you know, the Netherlands was becoming a really rich culture because of, you know, sugar and coffee and so on through the Dutch East Indies. So eventually he wrote a novel that's, you know, it's a kind of an autobiographical novel, but with a different name, called Max Havelaar, about a guy who, it's basically his story. He goes there, sees what's happening, comes back. So it's an expose in the form of a novel. And this novel, Max Havelaar, came out when Bavinck was six. So it's part of his childhood, and it was explosive. It was the novel, it's been called, that killed colonialism. And it's profoundly anti-Christian, anti-colonial, anti-Calvinist, all of these things. And it still is a factor, and it's a classic of Dutch literature. So if you go into a Dutch supermarket today, the fair trade brand that you have on bananas, for example, is called Max Havelaar, named after the novel. So you see it in the supermarket even, in terms of the Dutch consciousness towards the effects of colonialism on Java. So this book came out when Bavinck was a child, and it had a huge impact. It was just massive, so he's the first atheist Dutch literary great, and it's a book that then accelerates the de-Christianization and the secularization of Dutch culture, and this is just part of Bavinck's cultural context as he's growing up, that Multatuli is wildly popular with Dutch young people. So Abraham Kuyper, for example, when he was young, before his conversion, was a big Multatuli fan. He gave a copy of Max Havelaar to his girlfriend's parents to try and win them over to its way of thinking and to civilize them by getting them to read some great new literature. So this is just there in the background. And then when Bavinck went to study at Leiden, he went to a debating club where Multatuli was the speaker. And what Bavinck was really struck by was a confusing experience, because as a Christian, when you hear about the exploitation of the locals in the East Indies, and it was truly appalling, Bavinck's conscience is really pricked by this, to think this is awful, and it's good that this atheist is standing up and denouncing it through a sense of justice and righteousness. And yet at the same time, the novel is also a kind of parody and attack on Dutch Reformed Christianity as complicit in this whole system of oppression and exploitation. So, you know, it's a confusing experience for a young person in that kind of a setting. So what do you do with that? So he heard Multatuli in person. We know from his receipts book that he bought a copy of Multatuli's work there, and he engages with it quite a lot throughout his mature thought and his writing as well, because he's such a huge figure in the Dutch landscape that you can't ignore him. So Bavinck is really ironic and always tries to find the grain of truth even in the arguments of the person that ultimately he's not on the same side as. And Bavinck's and one of his most important parliamentary speeches later in life, when he was a member of parliament, he praised Multatuli for the capacity of his soul to be filled with righteous anger against things that need to be changed in the world. But he says at the same time, I never bowed down at his feet like my friends did. So, but what's really interesting in his student years, when he first hears him and enters his company, is that at the debating society around the same time, he also hears this young upstart in the Dutch Reformed Calvinist world, Abraham Kuyper, and was really captivated by him as well. So Multatuli, on the one hand, is saying, you know, we need to have an atheist future, we need, and Christianity is a part of the problem, it needs to go, and we need a secular future. Whereas he also hears Kuyper presenting this completely different view of where Dutch culture needs to go, which is that Calvinism answers all the problems of modern life, and has all the resources, it needs to be developed, but I, Abraham Kuyper, I'm developing it, and I want other young theologians to join me. So what I think is really significant is that Bavinck buys Multatuli's book and really reads it thoughtfully, right. But around the same time, he also buys a picture of Abraham Kuyper, a Kuyper poster, and so you can imagine that on the wall of his room as a student. Kuyper also does what Bavinck is looking for. He also is really passionate, can be very fiery about things that need to change in the world. So I think it's such a fascinating point of Bavinck's life to be able to look in on, as he, you know, just this privileged education again means that he actually comes into direct contact with these people who are trying to shape visions of the future.
Yeah, I'll show me a man's library, and I'll show you the posters on his wall, and you tell me which are more effective. Yeah, I think that's quite telling and interesting, and that's again something that could only be seen through the hard work and doing the critical work and digging through receipts books. It's tremendous, just to see that window into Bovink at the time, and it sets him on a path.
As you're giving us sort of a window into his time at Leiden, I would be interested in learning a little bit, or you talking a little bit more about that experience. You know, what was his education like? Who were his most influential professors? Moving from a place like, my understanding is moving from a place like Kampen to Leiden, what would have been unsettling in some ways. Tell us a little bit about his experience there in Leiden, in addition to what you've already highlighted for us.
Yeah. So I guess to fill in viewers who haven't read the book yet. So he studied as a resident student at his denomination seminary for a year. But he didn't really, he didn't engage much with the seminary while he was there, because in that kind of context, in that era, if you went to study theology, first of all, you had to take general humanities classes and then pass a general humanities exam to show, can you read, can you write, can you think? So a lot of his peers at the seminary didn't have prior education. So, and for Bavinck, who'd gone through such a prestigious track as in his secondary schooling, and his high schooling, those classes were completely redundant. So just after he arrived, he got permission from the professors not to go to the humanities classes, and because he didn't really need them. And instead, he had permission immediately to take the exam that would then qualify him to study in the theological classes. But he didn't take the exam immediately. So he was in Kampen for a year, but he doesn't seem to have been very engaged with the seminary or that kind of thrilled to be there as an academic environment. And so after that 1 year, he then moved to the University of Leiden, which is this, you know, extremely prestigious ancient university. But again, he didn't go straight into theological classes, because you have to do your humanities period first. So he spent 2 years taking classes in mathematics. He did 2 years of Arabic. He did logic. I mean, just the whole kind of spectrum of courses in that period. He didn't enjoy all of them all that much, and he quite often complained that they were a bit boring. He thought some of his lecturers were, his professors were amazing, others less so. So in that period, he's not actually engaging with the kind of liberal theology, the heterodox theology that you have in Leiden for the first couple of years. But what he's shocked by initially is more the struggles that he had culturally with being a member of this Orthodox Reformed denomination in a larger city, a kind of culturally secular city, because he'd grown up in smaller conservative and culturally Christian towns. And then he goes to Leiden, and you know, the student culture is all about, you know, drinking and swearing and challenging orthodoxies. So he was shocked initially by to work out, how do you follow Jesus here? Because this isn't an environment that I've been in before. Can I become a member of the student society or not? And the student society was the kind of thing that you know, you join to make social connections and feel like you're really an insider at this elite institution. But he didn't join the society, which again revolved around just drinking far too much alcohol and generally not pursuing a life of godliness. But if you didn't join the society, maybe an eighth of the students didn't, you were known as one of the piglets. That's how the society members looked down on you. So he's an outsider there in that regard, in Leiden, and on the periphery of things a bit. And also, he's part of the new middle class that hasn't existed for all that long in Dutch culture. And this is an elite university for the sons of the aristocracy. Most students have double-barreled surnames, or, they're from very privileged backgrounds, and they, not all of the students appreciated having these, new middle class upstarts like Herman Bavinck appearing at their institution. You don't have blue blood, you've got the wrong kind of surname, and, you're from this weird conservative church. So initially Leiden was more of a cultural shock to him than a theological shock, because he wasn't doing theology for the first couple of years. His pastor really helped him to adjust to that and led by example in trying to be an integrated Calvinist in that kind of a social setting. And his pastor also had lots of interactions with the university as well, and that really helped him. When the time came to start taking theological classes in Leiden, he almost backed out and almost moved back to Kempen to study there, but he carried on and was really nervous before he started to take classes with professors who were national celebrities. I mean, they were huge names across the whole country, and they were, you know, not famed for their commitment to orthodoxy or anything like that. Right. But I think the experience was an odd one for Bavinck, because what he experienced was toleration more so than anything else. The systematics professor that he studied under was really famed for his heterodoxy. But by the time that Bavinck was his student, this guy was quite an old man, was intellectually extremely predictable. You know, he hadn't written a major new work for 30 years, so you had quite a lot of time to get to know how he thought before he would actually talk to you, and you knew exactly what he was going to say. So there weren't those, you know, shocks of new challenging thoughts. So he wasn't particularly, I don't think it was a particularly difficult experience in that regard. I think he made a lot of choices quite pragmatically as well about who he studied with and what he worked on. So when it came to his doctoral dissertation, for example, Abraham Kuyper wanted him to do Old Testament because Abraham Kuyper wanted an Old Testament professor for this new university that he was planning. But I think for Bavinck that would have been, well, it would have been its own distinct challenge. To do an Old Testament dissertation if your supervisor was, you know, one of the most famous higher critical scholars in the world at that point, a guy called Abraham Kuhnen. He was also interested in doing a dissertation in church history and his looking at the secession of his own denomination. But again, that how you do that in that kind of a context, if you're from that church, also was fraught with difficulties or just challenges. He ended up working in ethics for his dissertation, working on Zwingli, which I think was quite a safe choice for him, actually, because he was working with this guy Johannes Scholten, who was the systematician, you know, who was really predictable and was a huge name, but was, you know, he only ever engaged with Bavinck's doctoral work in terms of typos and grammatical mistakes, but he, you know, he was like a spent force by that point, so he wasn't going to try and challenge him too much in terms of doctrine. But the person who really influenced them in Leiden was this Old Testament scholar, actually, Abraham Kuhnen, who then took over in practice with supervising Bavinck's ethics dissertation. And the whole process of that's really interesting because Kuhnen was really a polymath in theology. He taught ethics as well for a long time in Leiden and was extremely well-read also in Zwingli, in contemporary scholarship in Zwingli, and was also extremely charitable. So he was very far from Bavinck theologically, but exemplified charity and grace and Irenicism towards Bavinck, taught Bavinck how to present your opponent's viewpoints in their own strongest terms, how to avoid straw men, and also in terms of historical scholarship, how to understand a theologian's works as they develop over that person's lifetime. So Bavinck learns all of these skills from Abraham Kuhnen, interestingly, and his scholarship actually in rigor and in method, although not in, I guess, presuppositions or conclusions, but the mechanics of how you do scholarship very much resembles Abraham Kuhnen, but also the personal example of being charitable and generous and winsome towards people you don't agree with. He learned profound lessons from Kuhnen.
It's interesting to see how this plays out moving on, because as Bavinck leaves the university, and he's definitely accomplished, he's certainly capable, has invitations to teach at a variety of places. If I'm not mistaken, I think he was asked to go to the Free University 5 times or thereabouts. But yet he ends up in the pastorate, and that it really ends up being a lonely time for him. What are we to make of that? What insights do we have in Bavinck's life in that period and then moving on into his more traditional academic career?
Yeah. So it's quite hard to find and to pinpoint exactly what Bavinck was thinking about the pastorate in his earliest life. So when he was a student in Kempen for that year, the things that he writes about his life then were that he wanted to study theology as an academic discipline rather than pursue a seminary education in theology. And he doesn't write then about wanting to be a pastor, but he keeps the door open to move from his Leiden studies to being ordained in his church. And he does all kinds of strategic things that keep him eligible for that. I think when he was enamored with Amelia, you can see in his diaries then that he's thinking, you know, together we could be a really good team, a minister and a minister's wife. She's a godly woman. We could work together. But then when that doesn't happen, again, I don't have a diary entry where he explains exactly what he's thinking on this, but certainly in terms of timelines, it looks like at that point he starts thinking, you know, if this doesn't happen, then you know, I could be a scholarly theologian. But I guess at that point, you know, he has different options that are open to him, and one of them is to pursue the academic path, to pursue, you know, university theology. So he's interested in that point in going to work in Germany. You know, German universities were very exciting in that period in the Netherlands. He also keeps an eye on what's happening in Edinburgh here in Scotland, where I now work, at New College, which was established originally by the Free Church of Scotland, by the Scottish Secession Church from the same kind of time. First as a school of divinity, but with the ambition that that would grow and become a Christian university in Edinburgh. So it would be a Free Church university. So he keeps an eye on what's happening here in Edinburgh as well. And so he has these ambitions, and his parents seem to approve of this as well, that they're happy for him to go and visit German universities and to explore a path there. But none of that happens. And he ends up becoming a pastor in his own denomination in a small city in the northwest of the country. And I think initially he looks like quite a reluctant pastor. He'd become accustomed to how you function in, you know, elite scholarly society and the kind of conversations that you have and the things, you know, that you talk about. But and although he passed the end exams in Campen that qualified him to be ordained, he hadn't taken any theological classes there. So he's aware that this denomination is animated by a kind of theology and piety that he grew up in but hasn't been schooled in. So for him to move from, you know, the University of Leiden and from his doctorate into a church that had all kinds of problems as well, in terms of previous pastors where things hadn't really worked out well, that was a really difficult thing for him, and he didn't really relish it initially. So he was quite a reluctant pastor. And you can see from things that he does at the very beginning of his time in the pastorate that he doesn't see this as his end destination, that he wants to end up teaching theology, probably in his own denomination, but to do that he has to pastor first. He also had a really high view of the pastorate as well and of the ministry, so it's not that he kind of looked down on it or anything. But, you know, he comes from a tradition where you're expected to have quite a keen sense of experiential assurance that you're doing what God wants you to do. You know, so his dad used to cast lots to determine the will of God.
Right.
He had big decisions to make. And Herman himself just has a lot of wrestling with uncertainty about the choices he makes in life in this early phase, and are they what God wants? So he's a reluctant pastor initially, and he hadn't preached that many times before he became a pastor, and most of the time it was in the same two texts. And then, you know, to step on the treadmill of a different text every Sunday, and, you know, really to throw yourself into the lives of people in a, you know, who are not part of the elite sliver of society that you've been in yourself for the last few years of your life, that was all quite difficult. And he was just so lonely as well. He went from the carefree life of a student to, because he was single, living with this older couple who were expected to do all of his, you know, cooking and cleaning and all that kind of stuff, and who treated him in an extremely formal way because he was, you know, Reverend Bavinck, and he couldn't be Herman with anyone.
He's the dominee.
Yeah, dominee. Yeah, so, you know, he just couldn't switch off with anyone, and that was a hard shift to adjust to. And his letters to his friends from that time and that year in the pastorate are really, I think they're instructive for pastors to read today because of the kind of questions he asks himself about his sincerity in his pastoral work. Is this just a role that I'm learning to act in? Or, you know, 1 hour of the day, you know, you're leading a funeral for someone that you might not know that well because you've only just become pastor. Then the next minute you're rejoicing with someone, and then the next minute you're leading a prayer meeting, and then you're writing a sermon. And how do you project yourself into all of these situations every day and be authentic and really mean what you do? So the questions that he asks are really thoughtful and you know, worthy of reading for your own self-examination, I think. But he really grows into the role, though, and starts to love the work that he's doing. And he was only a pastor for just over a year, but he was quite sad to leave it in lots of ways. So, you know, he, at the very beginning, you know, he takes on some academic work alongside this, you know, working for a journal, editing a volume of great theology in the Leiden Synopsis. So he's doing all these things that give him a bit of momentum to step beyond this. But then when he did step beyond it, he was genuinely sad to leave.
I could go any number of places, but I'm interested for us to close with his American experience. Mm. He comes over here to America. And of course, you know, he does have that background of being critical of those who emigrate over here. And so he has opinions that form about Americans and about America. And there is an experience that you record that he has with a certain Southerner, which he brings back and he shares with his people in the Netherlands. And I think instructive in so many different ways. But maybe, James, you can kind of take us as we're closing out here about his experience in America and what it was like for him and his thoughts and opinions about Americans and America in general.
Yeah. So he went to America twice, first as a younger man, and then secondly at a later stage in life. So the first time was in 1892. And he went there as an ambassador of this modern Calvinist movement that he was a part of. So he went to talk to English-speaking reform people who needed to know that being reformed should lead you to think about all of life for the glory of God and all of life in an intentionally Christian way, rather than just, you know, reformed as the 5 points of Calvinism and, you know, maybe pedo-baptism if you really take it seriously. But instead it's being reformed as this huge life vision in a kind of Kuyperian sense. But in that visit, though, he had this this idea of travel as an art, and that involves not passing judgment on the foreign. So he's very, you know, appreciative of and attentive to difference, and doesn't want to say whether it's good or bad in that phase of life. But he came back to America in 1908 to give the Stone Lectures at Princeton, and by that point he had completely given up on the elegant traveler way of thinking. And he was publicly polite while in America, but his own notes are full of critical observations. And some of them are, you know, they're quite entertaining to read today, like American teenagers are really rude and Dutch teenagers are very polite and all that kind of stuff, which is just quite fun to read.
Nothing changes. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it's probably changed in the Netherlands. Dutch teenagers would be pretty rude too. But one of the things that he pays most attention to is race in America. And it's the thing that he was, I think, truly shocked by. And I guess you have to remember that at this point, the Netherlands is an ethnically extremely homogenous country. It's much more diverse now. But, you know, so the whole experience is a really interesting one for Bavinck. But what he was really struck by in various places was it was just racialized hatred and even the segregation of Christianity along racial lines. He left all kinds of notes in his diaries, but also there are whole manuscripts where he's written about race in America, where he's tried to read literature by African Americans as well to try and understand what they have to say and about their experience. He was really fearful about the future, that that this would lead to increasing violence. And he used this again in the Netherlands to tell people, don't emigrate. So he was really fearful that the American experiment, as he saw it, would fail. That the only hope for it was what he called the path of religion. But by that he means, obviously, the Christian faith, which is, you know, he says, this is for all people, teaches that the whole of humanity is of one blood and needs one savior. But he was really fearful of how Christianity, as it was developing in America at that point, wasn't able to meet the needs of its day because because Christianity was also divided along racial lines as well. So the things that he writes about race are really striking. I mean, the reference that you made there, Jim, to what he was told by a Southerner, and he doesn't say who this is, but a Southerner told him that African-Americans aren't human, for example, and that they are half human, half ape. I mean, things like that really, really shocked him. You know, Bavinck was also very attentive to, you know, the latest developments in biology, evolutionary science, and so on. So, you know, the kind of stuff that he was hearing there was really shocking to him, but also just because of his commitments to the organic unity of the whole human race. So yeah, that really left him kind of shaken quite deeply, I think.
Yeah, we see a helpful window even for us Americans, Jim and I, to have a Calvinist and in many ways really faithful perspective on some of the darker portions of our own history. And those are major pain points even in this present day, but we need to look to Christ and learn about those things. And I think if we read the dogmatics, and particularly on Bavinck on anthropology, and then on Christology, we see the wonderful glories of what God has done for us in his providence and in his grace. I need to just tell you once again, James, thank you for taking the time to speak with us today. Thank you for writing this book. But of course, we want listeners not only get a copy of this, Bavinck, A Critical Biography, which is published by Baker Academic, but take a look at Trinity as Organism and also the previous, the new translation and edition of Bavinck's Christian Worldview, which is available from Crossway. So we'll have links to those books in the episode description. But thanks so much for taking the time, especially late on a Friday for you. It's been a joy and a pleasure. It's been an honor to have you with us.
Thanks, Wes. It's been great to talk with you guys. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Anytime. We'd love to do part 2, 3, part 10, whatever. You're welcome. Open door.
We could.
And I'd like to. But we don't want to keep you. Of course, you can find out more information online. We'll have all the links available in the episode description to places you would like to go. But of course, you can see and find out more about what we're doing at reformedforum.org. You'll find information about all of our other programs and events and publications. And we do want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.